Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. This is show number 138, and it is May 15th, 2023. I am your host, Tom Riddell, and co-host Terry Brown will be with us shortly. And today's show, we have on Suzette Bergman, and she wrote Desert Phoenix, and she'll be with us about 15 minutes after the hour here, about quarter after. And now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriddell.net. That's thomasriddell.net. In the blog section and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge, or find us easily on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRiddell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on a show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. Special note, we can now also be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike. And I also review books on both sites as well. And upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge, and this segment is where I usually announce our upcoming authors. But we all need a break. And guess what? In 2 weeks, we have Memorial Day. So Writer's Lounge is going to take a Memorial Day break, and then we will be back with you on June 12th. The author will be announced, has not yet been announced, but will be announced shortly, I hope. So that's that segment. On to the next segment, one of my favorite here on the Writer's Lounge, aside from talking to the authors, would be Writer's Topics, where we discuss the tools used in our little toolbox as we sit down to write stories. And I am very happy and proud to bring on my co-host, Terry Brown, at this time. And I will open the door to our imaginary studio here, and we have a nice little couch. And I'm going to invite Terry in here to sit down next to me. How are you doing, Terry?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing today, Tom?
I am doing fabulous. The weather is looking up. Things are really going in a nice direction here as far as the weather, and I'm really, really excited about the upcoming summer. And before we get into talking about the subject today, I do understand, young lady, that you do have an announcement coming. And this isn't the first book. It's not Sunflowers being announced or the second book. It is the third book of your storied career as a author. So can you reveal it or no?
Well, I can tell you a little about the story, but I'm not revealing the title today. I'll reveal the title the next time we talk. So the book is about a woman. Her name's Maggie. She's living in the 1890s in the North Carolina Appalachian Mountains. She's a healer woman. She has learned her skills from her grandmother and her mother, and it's been a generational thing. And she also befriends a Cherokee medicine man and learn some very valuable things from him, but that causes some problems in the community with some people who aren't sure whether or not they still want to have her take care of them if she's going to use, you know, the Indian medicine, because there's, you know, a little bit of the racism there that where people weren't sure that they liked that. Her daughter also goes into healing, but she decides to be a nurse. And as a nurse, she doesn't believe that what her mother does is valuable, and so there becomes the tension between them. At one point, Maggie believes that she makes a mistake that harms someone that she loves, and her daughter really pushes that, and that's kind of where the crux of the whole thing goes. So,
very good. I really like the idea that you've stepped back into even further into history, but gone back into the 1800s. I am really looking forward to that. It's one of my favorite times of history, right before we hit the 1900s. So I'm really looking forward to what's going on there. And of course, today we have Desert Phoenix, which is a story about the 1800s or early 1900s, but it kind of butts up to that wonderful time period where we had Civil War and everything else. So I'm really excited for you, Terry, and I can't wait for you to release the title and get down to reading that next book of yours. And so you wanted to talk today about point of view, which would be POV as writers know it. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know a little bit about it, and I know it can be very complicated when we're sitting down to begin writing and trying to choose which POV we're going to write in, because I think it's very important for a writer to do.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting. When I wrote Sunflowers Beneath the Snow and An Enemy Like Me, and even when I wrote the new one, I was using third-person point of view, which means that I kind of stand in the air and I write it so that we can see Maggie and we can hear Maggie's thoughts. And some of the points of view, I was looking up a list, and there's like, you know, omniscient and second-person twice removed three times on their head and upside down. Like, there's some that I don't understand. I read them, and it's like I don't even know what they're asking for. But one of the things that I wanted to try, I started writing my fourth manuscript, and it is not historical fiction. It is more of a contemporary, probably a little more comedic, think along the lines of kind of like Irma Bombeck type, you know, tongue-in-cheek, and it needs to be first person. So without thinking about it, I wrote the first chapter in third person, realized what I had done, decided I needed to change it, went back and wrote it in first person, and I'm not good at it. Like, I read it and I thought it looks like a sixth grader wrote it. So now I've kind of stopped writing, and I'm doing a little bit of research into what makes a good first-person point of view story, because all of my sentences were I, my. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is awful. I mean, it really did read like a sixth grader. So I thought, I've got to figure out what to do. So right now I'm listening to a book that someone recommended that's a first-person point of view that does well. I'm going to read a few books and, like, take notes. I'm not really reading them for the book as much as for what the author is doing. I've put several questions out there on some author websites asking for, hey, can you tell me a little bit about what you would do with first person? And I actually turned in that first chapter to a writing group that I'm in and just told them I'm really struggling with first person point of view. Help me. Like, what do I need to do? What would you do with this to make it better? Because I think that once I see it, I'll feel a little better about what I need to do. But my first attempt at it just didn't feel good at all. So
yeah,
that idea of changing point of view is hard.
Yeah, I think make it easier for me to try to figure out. I think first person is more like if you're writing a memoir. And you're writing it from your point of view. Yeah.
From what I understand, it can also be if you are writing from one character's point of view. In the past, I've always had three or four main characters. And so you can't write first person that way. But you can if you're writing from one person's point of view. So,
I'm writing. It is very interesting, and it can be very anxiety-provoking, I think, for writers to sit down and try to figure out, okay, I've got the story, but now I got to tell it, and how am I going to tell it? And it creates a little bit of anxiety. I'm writing a book. It's first person, and it has to do with myself as the main character, because it's about the Uber ghost, as some of people out there might know that I'm an Uber driver. Well, I had this ghost get in my car, and it goes from there. And he wants me to reveal about his life, which was in the late 1800s when he was killed over a gold pocket watch. And he is a tailor in Syracuse, New York here. And so what I did is I used that to tell the story about this rider in my car. And then what I do later on in the story is I find a book, which is actually a diary that this ghost had written. And then I include that into the book kind of to break it up a little bit. But it's sort of my first person. It's a first person coming from me. And then it reverts to Benjamin Murphy. That is the ghost character in my book. And he starts telling his story as he did when he was alive back in 1800. So it can be very anxiety provoking. And I hope you do well. I'm sure you will find a way. It just takes a little bit of effort. And I'm glad you got that support group. Now, in your other books that you wrote, Sunflowers was not in first person. It was more like you say third person, right?
It was third person. It's what they would call third person omniscient, which means that I have the point of view of all the different characters. There can also be third person limited, which is where you only know what's going on in some of the characters' minds and not all of them. And then first person, and then second person, I think, would be really unusual to write in second.
It uses the
pronoun you.
Yes, and from what I understand it, it's very seldom used in fiction. Most of it's used in nonfiction, where you talk about you set it up and you do this and you do that, sort of a...
Yes. More of a self-help type.
Self-help, exactly. Took the word right out of my head. That's how that is. So that's very rare to see that. So it's basically first and third for for our purposes here as writers,
right,
most
right.
of the time that we use. So find it very interesting. I'm sure there's a lot of books out there on it. I would encourage anybody out there that's listening to go and search your library or online and try to digest that all. And hopefully you come away feeling a little less anxiety provoked by all that. But let's get on to the next segment, which is the featured segment of the Writer's Lounge, and it's a guest author intro and interview. And we have on Suzette Brueggemann, and she wrote Desert Phoenix. And I want to remind everybody that you can give us a call if you're listening live to the call to the show, and you can call in by area code 914-219-0868. Once again, that's area code 914-219-0868. And my review of Desert Phoenix: before the turn of the century, Lou is a young girl living in gold country. She loses her family to yellow fever, and she soon finds herself forced into prostitution. The other girls take her under their wing, and they give her the name Tempa. The business is frightening for her, but she finds comforts and luxuries within the crib that she only dreamed of as a poor child growing up. She meets an older girl named Belle, and they become best friends, and their relationship would last a lifetime. Tempa grows into learning her profession and becomes very good at it, but she is also able to keep a piece of herself, and she strives to help others in healing their wounds with herbs. She meets Henry, a young German immigrant, along a riverbank, but he is badly injured and near death. She nurses him back to health and learns that he was attacked, and the man who beat him is still on the hunt for him. Soon, Tempa and Henry become close, and he puts his trust into her. She reads books to him and talks to him, and she too finds that she is becoming attracted to this boy who is not yet a man. A love story begins, highlighting the many hardships and realities of life back in the Old West. What will become of Tempa and Henry? Will they find happiness, or will their situations in life prove to be too difficult for them to be together? It's exceptionally rare to be completely captivated by a story from the first page to the last, but this one did it. Suzette Brueggemann strings together words that are enchanting and vibrating with an energy that takes this novel to the highest level. She touches on subjects and themes that are not for the weak of heart, but in telling this tale, which is inspired by a true story, she allows us into a very real and difficult time when life brought out the best and worst in people. I fell in love with Tempa and Henry, but I was also shocked by some of their behaviors and some of the decisions they made. This is high on my list of best reads for this year. It's a story that will certainly stay with me for years. This is certainly a must read. Now it is our pleasure to welcome Suzette to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And I'll reach over here and open the door, and hopefully she'll step through it. And Suzette, are you there?
I am. Hello, Tom. Hello, Terry.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
It's great to hear you, Suzette. And I have to tell you that we've been going back and forth in our emails, and I really laughed when I first of all, I read your book and I was blown away by it. It is really near the top of my list, if not at the top, but it is really far up there for reading, not only just this year, but for several years. It makes my top, I think, 5 out of 100 books that I've read. So
That's such a compliment.
I let you know about that. But I really laughed when you had said that this book was your training wheels book. And I had said to you that I think it's time that you take your training wheels off, because this book is more like a Tour de France professional bike ride, if you want to use those analogies. And I know Terry could relate to that. So, but anyway, Suzette, you have enjoyed a colorful and interesting life and have some great stories to tell other than the Desert Phoenix. Tell us more about yourself and what's the story we hear from you about Butch Cassidy.
Well, I'm a fifth generation Nevadan. I grew up there, clear back from my great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, on and on. But right now I find myself living in Montana, the land of ice and snow, for the last 20 years. So quite the change. But in my heart, I'm a Nevadan, and that's where I love to be. That's where my family lives. That's where my heritage is. And I love to be there. I love to learn and explore, and it's just the place of my heart. So the story of Butch Cassidy. My great-grandfather was a freighter, and at the turn of the century, he had a wagon and a team of horses, and he would take supplies from the train depot into all the gold mining camps in southern Nevada, and then he would take the ore bullion back out to the trains. And there's a route that those freighters would use that cuts through the mountains and just an old dirt track. And right where my parents have built their retirement home, there's a white cliff. And on that cliff are etchings and writings in axle grease of freighters' names as they camped underneath the cliff and passed. It was kind of a little rest stop for them with some water. And back in the day, my great aunt Frill's sister, my great grandfather's sister, had a home right next to the white cliff where all the freighters would stop. And the family story is that one day Butch Cassidy rode his horse up onto her front porch and leaned down without getting off and knocked on her door and asked her for some fresh water. And his name, L. Parker, his true name, is written on the cliff there right next to my parents' home. And every time I go, I have to take a picture of it because the weather and sunlight is fading it over the years and it's becoming hard to see, but it's still there. And
wow.
So that's just kind of a fun piece of Nevada history.
That is fantastic. I always think some of us out there don't understand that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Sundance Kids.
We kind of think that maybe this was a fictional tale, but it was a true tale. And anyways, before I stumble all over too many more of my words, I'll let Terry take the next question.
Alrighty. So how did the story about Tampa and Henry come about? And then, what attracts you to stories about the Old West?
Well, when I was in middle school 35 years ago, part of the curriculum was to write a Nevada historical essay. And I went to my dad and I said, Dad, I have to write this essay. I want to write something choose a subject that nobody has ever written about before, something different. And he said, well, you need to write about Henry and Tampa and tell their love story. And, in the mid-80s, there were people that were still alive who, as children, had known Henry and Tampa. And so my dad, who had grew up in Nevada, was my high school principal in Nevada, took me around to these old-timers, old people that were still alive that had experiences with Henry and Tampa, including my grandfather, Real the Freighter's son, who had ridden the range with Henry and Frill as a teenager and had listened to them talk and tell stories. And so I was able to go interview these people and glean little bits and pieces of this amazing story of this crib prostitute who was in her middle ages. She was probably 35 and Henry was around 20, and they met. She was kind to him, helped him, and they fell in love. And I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but their story spans, their lifetimes, all the ups and downs of the things that happened to them. And so I was, as a 13-year-old child, wrote this little essay about these two people and was able to find some historical photographs of them. And then it sat in my box of childhood mementos for, you know, 30 years. And then I came to writing late in life. It wasn't something I had ever even considered doing or aspired to do. I have three sons, and my oldest son as a child was just a tough kid always from birth. And as he grew up, you know, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems. And he was defiant and argumentative and had behavior problems. And by the time he was in his later teenage years, he had started to dabble in drugs and alcohol. And it was a really dark, dark time for me as a mom. You know, just the worry, the despair. We tried, you know, different things and couldn't ever get him on a good path. And then on his 18th birthday, he moved out of the house to live on the streets to use and sell drugs. And so it was just this horrible, horrible time. And one day I had the thought, you need to novelize Henry and Tempest's story. And I'm a creative person by nature. I have a lot of, I love words. I'm a songwriter. And at that point, I just needed an escape. I needed somewhere for my mind to go to process and to just kind of keep sane. And as both of you are writers, you know how deep in your head you have to go to, you know, to create these peep characters in this world. And so I thought, well, you know, this is better than me drinking or using drugs. I'm going to try this. And so I went on Amazon and bought every book I could about the craft of writing that had a 4 or above star rating. I bought about 20 books and I read every single one of them and took notes and just kind of taught myself the craft of writing as I started to research more about Southern Nevada, the mining camps, you know, the industry of cattle ranching and mining, all, you know, just really immersing myself in that time in life, and visited all the places that are, you know, that are in the book, and started writing the book as I learned the craft of writing. So it truly, truly is my training wheels book. And 2 years after my son moved out was about the time I finished my first really comprehensive draft of the book. I also applied to some writing conferences with portions of the book, got accepted to Yale and Squaw Valley, some of the, you know, the elite ones that gave me some confidence. And so all of this was going on while my son was away from home. And it was just such a mercy for me to have something to focus on as we lived in this state of worry. And then 2 years after my son left, about the time I was finishing my first solid draft, he came home and said, "Mom and Dad, you were right about everything. I'm so dark. I miss the light," basically. And we took him to treatment, and that was about 8 years ago now. And from that moment, he's never relapsed. He's been sober. He's just this amazing, solid, wonderful man. He married a wonderful girl, and they just had a set of identical twin girls. So we have this really happy ending to this what should be a tragic story, and we have this, you know, really fairy tale ending, and I'm just so grateful and feel so blessed. But I really credit, you know, my foray into writing and Henry and Tempa for getting me through that really dark, harrowing time in my life. But then, you know, I didn't understand the process of trying to get a book published. I just thought you wrote a book, and that was it.
Right.
As you
well, you've done, Suzette. You've done very well. Those books really helped you along, from my view of things. You know, reviewing books as I have, you've done really well with that. Exceptionally well, I would say. And Terry and I have written historical fiction, of course, and we absolutely love doing research. And from what I know about you, you do too. You just explained it to us. And what was that like for you researching Desert Phoenix? You've put in a lot of time, and did you have any problem like Terry and I do when we get into research where something that we find that we're researching kind of pulls us away and we get into this other world of it's really amazing when that happens. Did that happen to you?
Yes, but kind of in a bad way, I would say. You know, the main focal point of this book is prostitution and the sex industry, basically in the early 1900s and the turn of the century. And so I studied lots of academic thesis papers, research papers, you know, texts on prostitution, and to really learn about it and get the details right. I think Hollywood kind of glamorizes, you know, the parlor house girls and their flouncy outfits and, you know, and whatnot. And I think that they've kind of done a disservice to the women who led that lifestyle. And so I wanted to really get an accurate, you know, portray an accurate description of Tempa's life. And so I spent a couple years just really reading prostitute books, and I lost myself in that and almost developed a negative view towards humanity a little bit, just because these women were so taken advantage of and not allowed any dignity and respect and choices. They had no choices. You know, 99% of these women didn't, you know, choose to work in the sex industry. It was something that was forced upon them, you know, by circumstance. And most of them didn't live past 30. And so it was just, I lost myself in that research and felt myself turning negative towards, you know, humanity. So I had to, change my mind. But I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And I could tell that you did an awful lot. And one of the elements of your writing that took it to a much higher level, as I explained, of success was that than other books I have reviewed, is your descriptive ability and to draw out emotion from the reader, as you just related to as far as talking about prostitution. But there's one sentence that captures the example perfectly in your book, and I'm going to quote it here. And this really, really hits it home as far as writing what you, you know, what is it? Don't say, or how's that go, Terry?
So you're supposed to don't tell. You don't tell. You show, don't tell.
You show, don't tell. Well, tell me if this
hits
that mark. His palm flattened her lips against her teeth, trapping the scream inside. There you go. And it was exceptionally well done throughout your book. And when you sat down to write that very graphic scene, what was going through your mind?
That was actually the last scene I wrote. The last, even though that's right at the first of the book, I wrote the whole book and then came back and wrote that opening chapter because I wanted to really be solid in my skills. I read, just to get me into that mindset, I read, do you remember Elizabeth Smart, the girl that was taken from her home in the night? She was a young teenager, same age, 15, 14 years old. And then that, I can't remember his name, but he kept her for 9 months living on the streets and, you know, sexually abused her. And she wrote a memoir, and now she's a advocate for, you know, victims of sexual abuse and sexual assault. But I read her memoir just to really understand what it would have been like for a girl to be assaulted, you know, especially a girl back then who had probably very little knowledge about sex and, you know, they didn't have the media and pictures and nudity was so taboo. And then she's violated, and So that was a really hard thing for me to write. And again, I studied Elizabeth Smart, her memoir, to really get into the mindset. But it's also a controversial scene. As my reviews start coming in, and I knew it would be, but people, you know, where it's kind of right at the first of the book, a lot of people don't want to continue to read because you know, it starts out with the sexual assault of a child, which I completely understand. But I do have a warning. I do have a reader's warning, and I don't feel like it's graphic. You know, it's not gratuitous, and it just kind of hints at what happened. Did you feel that it was? Do you feel like it was graphic for you?
It was graphic in terms of, no, graphic would be the wrong word. It was very, I could picture what was going on, and I could feel what was going on. But it isn't graphic, like you said. It's not gratuitous. We're not getting all the nitty-gritty, every little detail, so that we, you know, there was no need. You told enough detail to make everyone really understand what was going on and understand her terror, but not, we didn't have to hear everything. So, no, I didn't think it would be called graphic.
Okay.
It's very descriptive. Like, I think it did a good job of capturing the emotion. And I think maybe that's probably what scares some readers off. Anyone who's going to be triggered at all by something like that, the emotion is so real and so raw that you don't have to be graphic if you capture the emotion right.
Right.
And so I do put a trigger warning right at the right, you know, in the description, so people know what they're getting into before they buy it. And I respect that. It's definitely not for everyone, but I think there's a lot of light in the book and a lot of good messages. So I feel like I needed to include her whole journey.
Yeah, when I mentioned graphic scene, it was graphic because if you are a good writer, you don't have to, as Terry said, you don't have to go into all the little details of what's happening. You can visually see it, and that makes it graphic, but that's where it sort of stops, where you don't get too far into it. And I understand how it can trigger people, but again, you and I and Terry are writing historical fiction here, and it's important that we paint a picture that was very close to probably the truth of the story. And I don't think that if you glossed over this part or you didn't tell this part of the book, it wouldn't have come off as good as it did, especially from my view and my opinion.
And to be truthful here, full disclosure, I don't know specifically that happened to Tempa. I don't know how she descended into prostitution. But as I read everything I could, you know, about prostitution, it was just a common story that, you know, a young girl had been sexually compromised some way. And once they were, they were not fit to work in polite society or to be married. And so I know she was Lou Taylor. I know she came from Illinois. I know some of her backstory, but I don't know the specific of how she became a prostitute. And so I told a likely tale of the situation.
Well, and I think that's what you have to do with a lot of the historical fiction characters that we learn of. You know, we're trying to stay accurate to their story, but we might not know their whole story, and no one does, and no one ever will. And so you do have to kind of just pick and choose and say, well, you know, what is a good likely possibility for how that happened?
Yeah.
Because you need to be able to move the story forward. You know, you're not actually doing a biography. This is fiction. And so, you're allowed to take some license with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Terry, you have the next question.
Yeah. So I'm curious if you could have your readers take away one thing after reading your book, what would you want that one thing to be?
Couple things. One would be take away from this specific book. Was that the question? There's two themes. I think one is there's a quote that says, some people sin and some people are sinned against. And oftentimes the line is blurry. I'm just glad I'm not the judge. I just think, you know, oftentimes we label people or judge them based on, you know, what they look like or you know, whatever. But there's so much more than that meets the eye, and there's so much more to the story than we know. And so it's just such a good reminder to me that we can't judge each other. We just don't know. We just have to love each other. So I hope that that's a takeaway from the book. There's another takeaway for me, and there's a line that says, there's always a gift. And, you know, when Kempa finds herself in her first brothel in Butte, Montana, she develops a friendship with Belle, another prostitute, an older girl, who helps her navigate the new world, and then they stay together their whole lives. And when she gets this relationship with Belle, Tempa recalls a line that her mother had told her, there's always a gift. And it seems like in life, there's always, like with the story I just shared about my son, his addiction, you know, because of that, I developed the skill of writing, and I felt like this was such a gift for me to, you know, kind of have a place to go in my mind to escape, you know, my dark thoughts. And so that was my gift from the time, you know, that dark time in our lives. And I think, you know, oftentimes when we can look back, there's always a gift. There's always a good something amidst all the bad. And
right.
You know,
that's what I call the silver lining. It's that ability to yes, some really yucky things are happening, but can you find any of the blessings that are in among it? Is there anything that, you know, and usually if you focus your attention that way, you can find things. You know, even in the worst of circumstances, there's usually something. There was a story, and I can't remember now. Oh, the name is going to escape me, but it was a Jewish concentration camp victim thankful for the fleas.
The fleas, Corey Ten Boom, yes.
Very good. Yes. Thank you. I knew it was a name that it was on the tip
the
of my tongue.
Place. Yes, my favorite book. The
fleas. But, you know, that idea that you know, she was thankful for the fleas because that meant that the guards didn't come in. And because the guards didn't come in, then they had more freedoms.
Yes.
And if it hadn't been for the fleas or the lice or whatever it was fleas or lice, or maybe it was both. So I like that idea. That's really good. That's great.
Suzette, you had mentioned in the email that you weren't sure if men would connect as much as a woman would to this love story. And, you were worried that I may not connect because it is, you know, even with everything that we've discussed here in regards to prostitution, it is a love story. Does this thought impact you as a writer going forward? And what other stories and books are you working on?
That's a good question. when I wrote this story, I do you remember a few years ago, a long time ago, there was a deodorant commercial that was strong enough for a man but made for a woman.
Yeah.
Made for a woman.
Yeah. Yes, I do.
yes.
that was kind of my motto to myself when I wrote this book, that I wanted it to be strong enough for a man but made for a woman. So it has a lot of those kind of rough and tumble Western vibe, you know, to it, with a lot of mining stuff and ranching stuff that I hoped would be attractive to men. But it's like I said, it was my first book that I wrote. It's solid historical fiction in a third person point of view. It sat on my computer for 5 years after I wrote it, just sat there. And in the meantime, our family started racing sled dogs, we live in Montana, and there's a whole nother story around to why and how we became a sled dog mushing family. So I wrote a book about it, and it's in first person from my son, my 12-year-old son perspective as a middle grader. And so my book is a completely different genre, middle grade. And that one was published a couple of years ago. And so, you know, I have a spectrum of, I'm not a genre writer at all, I think. I'm a songwriter. A few years ago, I wrote a musical based on the story of the Good Samaritan called Symphony of Life. And it's kind of in the vein of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. And we performed it as community theater. And it got such a good reception that I adapted the play, the script, into a novella, a 150-page novella, and had all the music professionally recorded by an orchestra and a band and live singers. And then I'm having that book illustrated. And every time there's an illustration, there will be a QR code so that you can click and listen to the songs that went along with the play as you read the book. And
I
so
love
that,
that so much that I'm sitting here in awe.
I'm so excited about this project, and it's almost done. And so this was, you know, more like Christian fiction, even though it's just a universal love your neighbor message. But so that's what I'm working on now. But I'm kind of all over the place. It's just whatever strikes. Got to be something really close to my heart. I don't know if that was a good answer to your question.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good answer. And I got to say that I do like love stories. One of my favorites is Bridges of Madison County. I don't know if you've read the book or watched the movie, but I absolutely love that story and everything that was in it. It kind of reminded me of Tempe and Henry in a way because they're older. You know, it's, again, we're not going to give away what happens to them, but I think it reflects well on we can think of Henry and Tempe, because after all, they were real people and they did exist beyond the story. And I think it's important too, and you did an extremely good job there. But what are your views on the right editor and publisher for your books, whether you're publishing in the traditional way or you're going it alone? And is there anything you would do differently in that regard?
Well, it's a hard business. I had no clue. Like I said, I thought you'd just write a book and it would get published and sit on a shelf somewhere. But, you know, as I've gone through this process, I've realized that only, you know, 1 in 1,000 maybe at the most gets actually traditionally published by a publishing company, you know, and that sits on a shelf in Barnes & Noble, that almost everything has to go through an independent self-publishing route or a small publisher. The first book I published, Skinny Leg, based on our family's dog sledding adventures, was published by a mid-sized publisher. And I was kind of taken aback that I didn't have a lot of creative freedom once I signed a contract. You know, they could had the freedom to edit the script and remove things that I didn't necessarily want to take it out. I didn't have a say in the cover of the book cover or even the title, although they did, I did persuade them to use the title that I wanted. But, you know, you lose so much creative control. And then, you know, you get very little of the royalties and even the marketing, you lose some of that ability. And so when I decided this, you know, to pull Desert Phoenix off my computer, I thought I'm going to try independently publishing this through Amazon to see if I can do a better job selling books on my own through this platform and, you know, put some money into it with sponsored ads and social media and see if I could, I can do that. And so that's what I've been working on the last few weeks. And it's, I don't know if either of you have gone the KDP Kindle direct publishing route. Confusing, and those sponsored Amazon ads are hard to figure out. So I'm in the middle of doing that right now, but it's interesting. It's a challenge. It's fun, but I have
I know.
All the control.
Yeah, Terry's got
a
lot of experience with a lot of that.
Yeah, I like having control of my work, and I would be like you. I don't want someone coming in and making decisions that, no, we're taking that out whether you want to or not, and this is the cover we're using whether you want to or not, and this is what we're calling it whether you want to or not. I have a friend. I was going to be involved in a local author's book-selling event, and I let her know about it, and her response was, oh, I can't. I'm not allowed to sell my books anywhere that my publisher hasn't set up.
Yes.
And I thought, yes, see, that would not work for me.
Right.
That would never work for me. I don't like people telling me what to do, and so that's just not going to work well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why you went with Atmosphere Press, because it gives
right.
you that ability to control, and it's, you know,
it's a lot
it's
like
working.
Self-publishing, but you get all of the professionals behind you. So it was really
right.
a good fit for me. But yeah, there are a lot of good reasons to do publishing in a lot of different ways. I think everybody has to find what works for them. You know, what are you looking for, and what do you hope to get from it, and what are you willing to put up with?
Yes, exactly.
Yep, yep. Yeah, it's hard when you let your baby out in the world and somebody takes control of it, and then you don't have any control over it anymore. I just can't see that happening. That's why it's so important, I think, to work hand in hand with whoever's working with you, that's the key words here, working with you
with
on that
you,
process
right.
to get that book, your baby, out into the world and make sure that hopefully it gets into the right hands and it's respected the way that you would like it to be respected. And, of course, dealing with before that all happens, dealing with the editor, too, I think is important. To have somebody
mm-hmm.
that's willing to, you know, give and take, and, you know, but the author, like Terry was saying, in my view, should have the final say of even what the editor tells you. Well, we want you to cut this, and now I don't know if I want to cut it. And okay, tell me why you think I should cut it. And then ultimately it would be your decision. So I think it's important. And I think, plug for Atmosphere Press. I think they've done very, very well. We've had a lot of authors on the show from them, Terry included, and I think they've done well. So yes, it can be a very anxiety provoking process. You know, writing is the easy part, but the hard part comes when you're trying to market the book
sure.
and get your baby out into the world. But anyway, Suzette, we're running close to the end here, and this is where we usually tell our authors that this is your Oscar moment. Do you have any parting words of advice or anyone you would like to thank for the successes you've had with the book or in life?
Oh, for sure. My grandfather, Wayne Lytle, took those stories that he heard Pempa and his dad Friel tell each other, you know, at the turn of the century, and wrote them down in his adult life. And I want to thank Grandpa for having the foresight to write those down, because those are the little anecdotes that I drew from in creating Desert Phoenix. And so it feels like a piece of Grandpa, a piece of my great grandfather, and my father and my uncle. It's just a legacy, and I'm just so grateful to have a part of that. So thankful to them. I'm thankful to my parents, because they have encouraged me to continue to persevere in this project even when I wanted to quit. And the reason why I decided to publish it is just basically so I could give it to them as a memorial. So I'm thankful to them. And I'm thankful to you guys for inviting me to be on your show. That's so flattering, and that
it
I'm so grateful you liked my book.
Certainly a pleasure. Right, Terry?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I might have made another friend.
yes.
I chase with Tom all the time. I end up writing to a lot of authors afterward, and then we become fast friends. And Tom's like, you know, he says, that's what I'm doing here, Terry. It's a friend service for Terry.
That's right. So it's Nasty Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. This is showcasing new friends for Terry Brown.
That's great.
So it's been a pleasure, and I know that I've been to your website, and I know that that's where people can contact you, but would you like to tell everybody in your own words where they can contact you if they want to read your fabulous book?
Yes, absolutely. I have a fairly active Facebook blog called Skinny Leg Life, where I post stories of our family and updates. Follow me there, and then feel free to contact me anytime at authorsuzette@gmail.com. And I love to get emails and buy my book. It's on sale for $4.99 for the electronic version on Amazon, Desert Phoenix. Find it there.
Very good. And thank you so much, Suzette, for being on the program. We loved it.
Thank you. And thank you, and have a wonderful spring evening.
Thank you very much.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, Terry, any final thoughts about Suzette and Desert Phoenix?
No, I mean, I think it was, you know, what a great conversation. You know, she obviously loves what she's writing about, and is, I love her dedication to being historically accurate. You know, when I hear a historical fiction author who's really dedicated to the history portion of the story, it just makes my heart sing, because that's, I just feel that's so important when you're dealing with historical fiction.
Yeah, we learn a lot as we listen to these authors, and they struggle with, you know, how much do we put in there? You know, the factual stuff is easy. You know, that's your foundation. You can build around that. But how you build around that is important to the ultimate story being told. I know that the story about my grandfather in Poppy's Prison was much like that. But I had him to take to study as far as learning his mannerisms and his character. And I filled in those blanks that we have sometimes when we're writing historical fiction. And I think it's important, too, like she was saying, some of the graphic material in the book enhances the fictional part of it. And if it does trigger you, I certainly understand it. But sometimes if you can push through that and really grab on to the better story that's there, I think it's important you do that, especially if you buy the book, because you know what's in it.
Right.
Right. So anyways, we will be off next time, Terry, and I want to also congratulate you for being on the Writer's Lounge broadcast. Now, this is your first year anniversary here, and we've enjoyed having you.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yes, yes. May 16th of last year is when you were here with us, and you made it for a year. So if you can stick around with me for a year, I think that says a lot about me and you. So anyway, we'll be waiting to hear your title of your next book, and then you're already started on the next one. So doesn't slow down.
But at least to a point, I don't know how, you know, I don't really know. I just start writing and things come flying out. So that's what's going on with this one.
Okay. Until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and good night. We'll see you on June 12th.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the